To episode 12, I believe we're on 12 at this point, of Hits and Gigs. My name's Noah Sherman. Dan's here.
Hey guys, what's up?
Dan's taking a picture. Savik's here.
Good to be back in Toronto, Noah.
Savik, look at me. Sick.
We have a special guest this episode, joining us for all of it, Nicholas Tristan. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great, Noah. Thanks for letting me join this hallowed circle.
Hey man, everybody gets one.
All right. Well, I won't waste it. My God, for years from now, people will be like, remember when Nicholas Tristan was on Hits and Gigs? And
boy, do I.
And people will be like, no.
God,
no,
no, hey, man,
God,
that was a
terrible episode.
Oh, God. I mean, Andrew Kessler died that day.
Whoa.
Sorry, that's an awful premonition. Let's hope that Andrew Kessler does not die today.
We say Andrew Kessler because he's going to be on the show later.
Yeah, Kessler.
Kessler, good guy.
Yeah. Yeah, man with a death wish.
What?
Man with a death wish.
Why?
Because he's going to die today. Dude, get with the times.
No. So he's going to join us. We're hoping that he's doing this Dragon Suite, or he did this thing called Dragon Suite, which was... Maybe I shouldn't explain it because it sounds really cool.
It's a new candy.
It's a candy.
Delicious Dragon Sweet.
He did this... It's an EP called Dragon Suite, and he did it with Lynn Homsey, violin player. So it's just violin and piano. We're going to let him talk about it, though. He's going to come on the show.
Oh, yeah.
We're also going to talk to Tom Richards, who is doing a 12-hour marathon show.
Wow.
Which is...
Like a marathon gig.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, they're going from 2 in the afternoon until 2 in the morning.
That's crazy. Is it to benefit something, Noah Sherman?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out later.
We will find out. Tom Richards will show us the way.
He's a horn player.
Yeah, he plays trombone, but he also plays, like... He also plays piano, and I feel like he won't be playing just one instrument for 12 hours, maybe. But, like, the way he described it, or the way it's described in the Facebook event is that, you pretty much pay 5 cents per minute, I'm pretty sure, that you want to go, and then he'll send you, like, an audio sample of the time you paid for.
Oh, cool.
So, like, it's a really interesting concept. So you get audio as part of your ticket to the show, right? I'm not entirely sure what it benefits, but I think it's benefiting something because it's on, like... A Kickstarter page or an Indiegogo, whatever we have here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Our non-union equivalent.
Yeah, right? I guess we want to jump right into a talking point, which we haven't done since... Fuck.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah,
we've actually had real content. People haven't had to listen to us.
It's,
but we're back.
Deal with it.
We're dealing with the heavies right now. We're back.
This is why no one remembers episode 12. This is But yeah, I feel like the last time we talked was like episode 3 or 4.
No, I think 5 or 6 we had a conversation. If not, let's go back through the archives, boys. Let's figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Best of. It's just nothing. It's like nothing.
No, I think the best thing and the only thing that is actually good that's ever happened is Savik saying it's gonna be fun.
Oh yeah.
To end the podcast.
What was the other thing you said? It was like PPD or something like
that. I have no idea.
You said something ridiculous. I don't know what it is.
I don't remember.
I didn't keep it in, but it was just like we're all idiots.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing let's see, how do I even start this? I went to see a show during the Jazz Fest. So that was like, when is the Jazz Fest? Like
that was a few weeks ago.
Mid-June?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
And it was Dr. Lonnie Smith at Horseshoe, which was like a really fucking cool show.
Yeah.
And I love the music. I love the vibe. I loved everything about it. I love the beer.
I love the beer.
But the thing that bugged me is like everywhere I looked around me, people were like recording the show.
With their iPhones or like recording?
With the iPhones show? Or anything. Yeah, just like, but there were just like screens up. Like white screens.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my way. And like, I don't like, this is kind of what I want to talk about is like the ethics of recording shows. Like not just from the artist's perspective, but like from the, from everyone's perspective too.
It's interesting that you, you shared the story, because when you told me that this was the topic we were going to be discussing, I was picturing sort of the old way of doing it when people, like, and I am using this term with a bit of love, like, you know, audio nerds would go in, or like completionists would go in and want and bring their, like, you know, tape rigs or something and record whatever cult artist, just so they could get the live sounds. And that's what I was thinking. I wasn't thinking of the epidemic of whenever you go to a concert, it's just a fucking screen, like, sea of iPhone screens or Android screens or whatever. Or what I've been seeing more and more is fucking iPads. People bring their iPads
what the hell
to
is
record
it?
Shows. And it's like, to me, that is a little different, because when you're recording on an iPhone, you're going to get just, like, crappy, noisy, shitty recording or shitty video, and it's like, and that's gonna eventually turn up on YouTube, and it's gonna get 14 views.
Yeah, as like a vertical,
a vertical video.
It's always vertical. Just like the entire screen is just like black sides to this like tiny little like pixelated shit.
Yeah. Meanwhile, someone is desperately looking for, you know, the song, and that's all they come up with. And...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think, Dan? How do you feel about like people recording shows?
You know what? I think it depends on the context of it. I think like, and since we're coming from kind of the context of like, you know, let's face it, we're a bunch of like jazz musicians, or kind of like we at least studied jazz at school, and that's kind of like where we're coming from to a certain extent. If we head to a show at the Rex and we're seeing someone we respect or like. Admire in their playing, sometimes we want to whip out our Zoom, or we want to whip out our iPhone and like record a solo or record a tune to go back and educate ourselves after, and like keep that memory of like, dude, I just saw this guy, he's so heavy, I really want to have like a snapshot of his playing and hopefully get something from it, you know what I mean? And from my perspective, I've done it. I've been at the Rex and I've like pressed record on my iPhone for a few tunes. I went to see Near Felder one time. Hey Near. And,
you see his brother.
Yeah, just
fart.
In case he's listening. Anyways, the Near Felder show. I don't know if it was morally cool or not, but whatever. I put, you know, had my iPhone on for a few tunes recording, and I got some really good stuff out of it. I lifted some of the stuff. I checked it out. I didn't put it online or anything. So, from a fan's perspective, from where we're coming from like a jazz school perspective. I can see why kids want to be, like, bringing their Zooms or iPhones to a gig to, like, kind of get a snapshot of their idols in action. Where, like, on a record, you're never getting the same thing as live, right? Like, no. Live is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
So getting a little bit of that and being able to go home and lift it and see what they're doing in the moment of, like, live, no turning back, no edits, no second or third takes. You know what I mean? It's a really, like, a whole different animal.
I see it in that sense for sure. Like, it totally makes sense if you're doing it to learn. And, like, who am I to guess at what people are using it for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't have a problem with that at all. You know, I mean, like, I don't know if the artist would. That's a whole other situation. That like,
well, it is another situation. What if the artist says, "Don't record me under any circumstances," whether it's to put online, whether it's to sell, or whether it's to, you know, lift my beautiful
secrets,
solo.
My secrets.
Yeah, I think in that case, if an artist specifically says, "Don't record this show," then I think it'd be wrong to do that.
Yeah, that's his right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I guess.
What I find it kind of, like, I think it's sort of a dual issue is that I have is there's, on the one hand, there are the artists who come out and are kind of a little precious about it. They say, don't record me under any circumstances. And if you are a jazz fan, you might guess I'm talking about Keith Jarrett, and I 100% am, because I think Keith Jarrett is coming from a place of arrogance when he is, you know, banning recording, banning photos, banning all this stuff. But on the other side, there's the entitlement of fans, and I would say a lot of this entitlement does come from people who are as Dan was talking about, wanting to lift solos, wanting to sing. They think they have a right to do this. And you don't have a right to do anything at a concert. The concerts, you know, the parameters of the concert are established by the venue and the artist.
You have a right to, like, sit down, shut up, and listen to the music.
I agree. So it's like, I don't necessarily agree with Keith Jarrett's position, and I think he's being precious, but I think he does have the right. I think the artist's rights do supersede the rights of the patrons in some regards. Like, I don't think Keith Jarrett should, you know, start spitting on people in the crowd. But if actually
we could do like an entire like segment of just Keith Jarrett stories, because he's such an asshole and there's so many like
could we get ridiculous... Keith Jarrett on the show?
No,
we can't record him.
No, exactly. No, it would steal his soul.
Like, okay, you get to record him, and you can only you get to interview him, but you can only take mental notes.
I think the context thing is really important too. Like Dan was saying, I think if you're recording a show for the purposes of education, that's fine. That's cool. But I've known people who have, like, recorded a show and then put the whole thing up on YouTube or, like, bootleg sites. And
yeah.
That's not cool.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It's cool if you're a Grateful Dead or a Fish fan or something.
One of those bands
that's one of those bands that loves that. Like, yeah. I know a friend of mine, they thrive on bootlegs, and that's kind of, like, that bootleg culture. But, you know...
Sorry, what do you mean they thrive on bootlegs? Like,
they encourage fans to do bootleg concerts for shows.
Okay.
So, you know, I think it's context, and I think the intent of the artist does really come into play here. Like, I wouldn't want to piss off, you know, whatever artist. There was a controversy, forgive me, I forgot the festival, but this summer it was She and Him, which is Zooey Deschanel and M. Ward's band, and they forbade any photos, any recording, any photos. And the press kind of jumped on it as a sort of like, oh, that movie star Zooey Deschanel suddenly doesn't want people taking pictures of her. But it was M. Ward. M. Ward has always had that policy. And so I think in those cases, you just kind of like, you're not entitled to take a photo of Zooey Deschanel and M. Ward.
No.
You don't have that, like, that's not guaranteed in any constitution I've read. Like,
I think another thing is just, if you're going to bootleg a show, like, just be a little bit discreet about it.
Yeah.
Like, if you're using a Zoom, you can stick, like, the entire Zoom into, like, a coat sleeve and just have the microphone
sticking. Yeah, sure.
And that's great.
Yeah, because nobody knows.
Yeah, but, I hate going to shows and just seeing on every table, like, a big white light from a phone or from something. It's just so aggravating.
You know how, like, you'll get, like a panoramic shot of a crowd, like, for something like New Year's Eve?
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that? Like, you know, Times Square, New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
And, like, I remember seeing two photos, one from, like, 1970, one from, like, this year, or last year. And it was, like, the one from 1970 was just, like, everyone, like, looking up, you know, like, enjoying what they were seeing. And then, like, the one from the past year was just, like, a sea of white screens, you know?
And, yeah, like, it's sort of become, you know, I think phones encourage, I've got to save this memory. I'm gonna want,
but you don't experience the memory. Like,
you don't experience at the time, and honestly, you're not gonna watch that video.
No,
who watches their shitty cell phone concert videos? Like, no, do you sit down? Do you gather the whole family around? Be like, come see the time I was 20 rows back at the Jay-Z concert at Air Canada. Like, no one. Yeah,
I think
that.
That's him there.
I think that's him there. No. That's just a tech. Like, no one does that.
Yeah.
We're getting a little off topic here to, like, phone.
Well, sort of. Like, this is kind of what I was, like, thinking about talking about.
I guess
is,
that's
like,
true, yeah.
That was how he started the whole thing.
It's true. Like, the thing that bugs me is when people will record it and, like, not actually, like, watch. Because I feel like you get the best experience when you're just watching the thing live as opposed to, like, looking at it on, like, a screen, no matter how big the screen is, later, you know? Like, I feel like the best experience, if you're paying for a ticket to go to a show, I feel like what you want to do, this is just me thinking, right? This is, like, how I think. I'm not trying to, like, pass off my views on others. I'm just saying this is what I think. But, like, I think that when you pay for a show, you want to experience the show as best you can, and you want to just, like, watch. And, like, I don't know if, like... Because when you're recording, like, you're oftentimes going to be looking at the screen, right? You're not going to, like, look at the show and also, like, just have the screen going. Like, you're going to be looking at the screen to make sure that it's a good shot, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It just, it bugs me when people do that.
Takes people out of the moment.
Yeah. I think so. I don't know. That's just me being bitter, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, that's a thing.
What about from, like, the artist perspective? Like, what do you feel... Because, let me just, like, there was a video that I saw of, like, Vinny Colaiuta, and he's, like, notorious for hating people recording him. Yeah. And it's him drumming for Sting. They're playing, like, 7 days, because that's all they play. And he's drumming along, and he sees someone in the crowd with a camera, and he starts, like, making faces at them. And, like, just being, like, an ass and being funny. And everyone in the crowd thinks he's, like, just making jokes and stuff, so everyone starts laughing. And so, and then he doesn't, like, focus as much on the drumming. Like, it's still amazing. But it's, like, taken away from Sting.
Yeah.
And you're just, like, looking at Vinny Colaiuta making these hilarious faces. And, you know, by that, like, the camera caused, like, Vinny to...
Like a diversion take away. From...
Yeah.
Well...
For me, from an artist perspective, as long as, like, if someone bootlegs a show that I play, as long as they're not making money off of it, I don't care.
Yeah, like...
But if you're, you know, gonna put that somewhere, anywhere, and collect ad revenue off it, then that's not fucking cool. I'll
tell you where you can put it.
I mean, even if you're, like, let's say a popular, let's say, whatever, a semi-popular artist, like, someone who's playing at, like, a smaller club in Toronto and, like, is not into you recording. Like, let's be honest here. Unless you're, like, going up there, you know, getting, like, the sound techs recording lines, whatever the fuck they do, and, like, getting some high-quality audio, you're not going to be able to sell that.
No, yeah, no.
Like, no one's going to buy, like, the audio from your iPhone or even your Zoom. Zoom is great, but, like... Let's be serious here. You can't, like, and like, if you, even if you, like, put it up on, like, some sort of, like, touring website, like, bootleg from X concert at Lee's Palace, like,
yeah.
Who the fuck is gonna listen to that? Like, no one. It's gonna sound like shit.
Oh, no, I've downloaded bootlegs before.
I guess so.
But how often do you listen to them?
I don't think it's a really big deal.
Well, I listen to them, like, 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
Until I get bored.
Actually, I have, like, one of my favorite recordings of, like, anything is a bootleg.
Like, what?
It's, Avishai Cohen.
Which one?
I don't even know. It's like some random show they did.
No,
like...
but which Avishai? Bass or trumpet?
Oh, bass.
Oh, that's too bad.
Duh.
Whoa.
Dude, Avishai... Let's get into an Avishai Cohen hang fight.
That should be a future episode. Yeah. Avishai v. Avishai. Well, one of the big business, potential for bootlegs is when artists premiere songs at shows. I know in the lead-up, the hype-filled lead-up to Yeezus, the new Kanye album, there were bootlegs of Black Skinhead and New Slaves everywhere, and I guarantee you that there were some high-quality bootlegs being sold for those. So I think the difference with bootlegs comes not when you're dealing with Avishai Cohen or some great Toronto jazz musician playing a show at the Rex or playing at a club in New York. It comes from Kanye or Taylor Swift or someone premiering a song in a very hyped up way. I think there is money to be made off that.
Okay, so in that kind of environment where like a top notch artist is debuting something and having that. You know, go out there before they want it out there.
Though you never know, because now maybe instead of being sold, which they might have done in the old days, maybe these bootlegs just go straight to YouTube, and YouTube makes ad revenue off of it.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point, because the whole, the YouTube thing, like, that's something we talked about in terms of, I think we were talking about, like, album sales at one point.
Yeah.
But, like,
we're talking about YouTube, streaming and everything.
Right. Yeah. But YouTube will actually, like, that'll count. You'll get ad revenue for that, and then that'll come back as, obviously... Yeah.
YouTube,
money in your pocket.
YouTube might have filters differentiating legal and illegal content for artists.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have those ad filters for themselves. They're selling that ad time on illegal shit, and they are raking in ad money on... Yeah, so...
Here's the thing. You say there's money to be made on these, like, hyped-up singles that are released...
I'm not recommending someone go into...
Yeah. No. But here's the thing. Like, the money... Like, the money is to be made by the bootleggers. There's no way that money can be made by the label if they put out...
Oh, no.
So, the label isn't losing anything, per se, right? It's just serving as more hype for the album, because if you buy this single, you're still gonna... And if you buy the single and you love it, chances are you're gonna buy the album.
Yeah.
Like, you're gonna want to buy the album even more, right?
Yeah. It's one of the reasons labels... I say labels don't like it, but that's a... big blanket generalization. Labels like to control the pre-hype. So if Kanye's single gets leaked and it's an unfinished live performance, and the media narrative is Kanye's new album is shitty and half baked based on this sample, on this, you know, this thing we heard, the label's like, no, we have the single ready to go, but we were holding it. So it's a control issue, and that's why labels don't like bootlegs, is because it takes the narrative out of their hands. They have to reshape the narrative once these bootlegs, mm-hmm. high-profile bootlegs, come out.
Mm. All right, so I think that just about does it for our discussion on bootlegging and just recording shows. It was more of like, for me, it was just more like a... It just pissed me off when I was trying to watch a show and they were like, everyone was recording in my way. That's pretty much...
It's an interesting conversation. It's a good topic to talk about, yeah.
That'll be future podcasts, is just shit that been pissing Noah off lately.
We did that with me once. That was a good episode.
Yeah, Savick goes for a rant or something like that. Yeah.
We did that?
Yeah. Yeah, Savick's rants. I think so, yeah. This was like back when we actually were all in the same room, like regularly.
There was like just a banter section where all I did was like bitch about something.
Yeah, we're all in the same room. Fuck.
What?
What did you bitch about?
Weren't you complaining about like, what was it like, oh, this is what an artist has to go through, this is what all the money goes through for
an
artist.
Oh yeah, those.
And you're like,
Facebook.
No, that's the same like, shit look, for everyone. It's like, buddy, this pays for our education and the money that you pay us for shows goes towards promotion. Like, no.
Look, buddy, you don't get paid for that, that's in your job description.
Yeah.
Anyway, so moral of the story for this, if you're gonna bootleg, don't be a fucking dick about it.
Yeah.
And if you're an artist, can you try to not be Keith Jarrett about it?
Yo, okay, this, I want to share this one story I heard about Keith Jarrett, okay? And I know there's like tons of them, but this was this year. It was like a few months ago.
Oh, yeah?
And I read this story, and I was just like, what the fuck? Like, I'm never seeing this trio again because, one, Jack DeJohnette sucks now, and Keith Jarrett's an asshole.
We're very, like, we're kind of negative about those two on this podcast.
Well, okay, I will just say this. Keith. I adore Keith Jarrett. I think he's maybe the greatest jazz pianist.
Oh, he's a great player. Yeah, don't get me wrong. He's a great player. He's just an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I love like, Keith Jarrett, too. Yeah.
So, what happened at this show was, like, I think it was in Italy or something like that. Or, like, Brazil, maybe. And he goes out to play. He sees that someone's recording in the audience. He says... He just, they don't even sit down and play. He just like gets, he orders his guys to walk off. So they leave. Someone like, some promoter comes out and like begs people to stop recording. So Keith Jarrett comes back out, yells at people. And then what he does is he gets the lighting guy to turn off the lights for the stage. So it's like pitch black on stage. You can't see them at all. These people have paid like a shit ton of money to watch this show. And now they're not watching a show. They're just listening. It's like radio, right? And so, like, everyone's getting pissed off because there's not a show to see anymore. And they do this for the entire show.
That, I think that's a cause for, you know, one of those show riots that you used to get, like, when people like, oh, man, this Stravinsky is so crazy, I'm going to riot about it. I would riot over Keith Jarrett turning the lights off.
Flipping some cars, putting shop windows.
Welcome to Montreal.
Yeah. It's like if Vancouver Canucks fans can riot over losing to Boston, then I am going to fucking riot over Keith Jarrett turning the lights off.
Fuck Boston.
So hockey's coming back soon.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to jump to this interview with Kessler?
Yeah,
let's
or should
do
we
that.
Talk about hockey?
Yeah.
Can we cut the interview? It's hockey.
Sports.
Yeah. If you guys are going to talk about hockey, I'm going to talk about StarCraft, and no one wants to listen to that.
Hits and Gigs became a sports podcast so gradually, I didn't even notice.
All right, so we're going to hear a little piece from Dragon Sweep, and then we're going to have a little interview with Kessler.
It's going to be fun.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome back to episode 12 of Hits and Gigs. That tune that you just heard was called Dragon's Dream from the Dragon Suite by Andrew Kessler and Lynn Holmesy. And Andrew Kessler's here with us. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Everyone's here. It's a big room full of people right now.
It's very, very cozy.
This is how it works. I try and be funny, and then it never works. So you said, just before we went on air, you said that this was the tune that kind of started everything?
Yeah.
How, like, where did it all come from? Like, what was the...
So when we were in third year, and Alin was planning her final recital, she had just come up with some ideas that she'd been working on her own just for this tune that she had called Dragon's Dream. And she showed them to me and said, Andrew, I'd really like to work on something. Let's, like, do something as a duo. Because we play together in so many other bands for other different people. And she's like, well, let's actually do something, just you and me. And I said, great. So I checked out her ideas, and they were so, like, crazy. You know, really hard melodic lines that were in unison, but also really, like, free sections of improvisation. So, and then we ended up just working together, and kind of her idea would inspire me to make an idea and vice versa. And then we ended up finishing this song called Dragon's Dream, performed it at her final recital. And my final recital, people really liked it, thought it was really cool. And then we just said, wow, this was insanely easy to write this kind of music, which is actually, like, rather intense. I'd call it a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
And it was so easy. So let's try and write a whole album in this genre.
Jeez. And you got 9 tunes out of it, eh? Something like that, or
eight tunes. I think, yes.
Yeah. How long did, like, the writing process take for this?
We could probably hash out at least a rough outline of a tune in a day. And but we didn't write anything down. We did everything with voice memo. So if we had a cool idea, we'd record it, send to each other. Or most often, we would just get together in a practice mod and would just say, I think we need a song that's kind of quirky sounding. So one of us would try and play something quirky, and then that would basically be like, oh, if you do that, then I'll do this. So we would just kind of write our parts based off it. Sometimes Olin would be like, oh, Andrew, you should try this on the piano, something like this. Or I'd be like, well, Lynn, you should make this crazy cawing noise on it. And so usually within a couple days we could hash it out pretty quick, and just since it's just two instruments, it's easy to get together and run sections and sections over and over. Mm-hmm. So the difficult sections we could nail pretty quickly compared to some other groups I've been in, but she's a pro.
Okay, if you could just speak a little bit to the recording process and how it was done. Like, it was all live, or were there overdubs in any kind of capacity?
It was all live. We were really lucky on our first session to have Roberto Acapinti come and just kind of hang out for the first half of the session. And what we would do is we did about 4 tunes a session. And again, since it's just 2 instruments, it's pretty easy to just get the ball rolling and tracking. Not much setup time, and, you know, we don't have to go and listen to takes. We kind of know if it's right. So we didn't use headphones to track. We're in the same room with each other. And so we do a couple full takes, and then Roberto suggested, well, in the classical world, a lot of the time they will run sections. They record sections, and they record the lead into the next section just as a buffer, but just to make sure that they know they have each section covered. So we would do a few full takes. And then we would do sections of, like, 20 to 40 seconds-ish, or, you know, a good chunk. And then, so after that, we had full takes that were completely usable, but this kind of music, the standard's so high that it has to sound perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good to have that recording of the sections in case we missed something. So that's kind of how it went. So it was pretty laborious, and it was really good to have Roberto, and Katie McBride was acting as producer, and, you know, they have amazing ears, so if we missed something, they could pick it out for us.
What would you actually, like, classify this music as? What type of music would you call it?
Well, I guess I would call it chamber jazz. It's got elements of chamber music due to the instrumentation, so it has a classical vibe to it. But it's not jazzy as in swing, ting-ta-ting, ting-ta-ting, ting-ta-ting. I should say that again. That was funny. But it has elements of jazz harmony and even some improvisation. So that, or contemporary classical crossover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Those are boxes that not many genres fall into. So.
No.
But there's nice alliteration, so it's all pretty well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listening to the album, I was struck by how you're really dealing in there's a whole, you know, warehouse of influences here. Like, there's one track in particular called Hysteria that really jumped out to me, because it's got, the intro is, like, it's essentially, like, a kind of, like, Xenakis, like, contemporary, classical, almost atonal, jarring, and then it goes straight into, I don't know if I'd call it blues or something, but it's very, you know, it's definitely sort of a 20th century contemporary mashup of different styles. And yeah. it's really, I was listening to this and I was like, it's like, you know, to use a $5 word, it's a very like postmodern thing where it's just like, you throw a bunch of stuff to the wall and whatever is good will stick. And, mm-hmm. and I really felt that on this album.
Yeah, that tune especially, Hysteria, was a bit of like the oddball tune where we just kind of went for something a little ridiculous. But we were dealing with the emotion of hysteria. Like, yeah. let's do something a little bit ridiculous. And, like, each tune does have, like, motifs that develop and get changed, but it's not in the traditional form of, like, an AABA. It's just kind of... there's an overture at the beginning that pretty much outlines most of the major themes you'll hear, but mm-hmm. you probably won't hear them quite the same way, but they are there. So it's a bit of a, like, you have to kind of shuffle for them, I guess, search for them. But it was kind of cool to have that approach and just say, like, okay, how bad can we mutate this theme but keep it in there? So maybe Lynn was playing it, but maybe I'll play it, and maybe I'll put my hand over the piano on the strings to muffle it to make it sound different, or I'll play it in a minor key or a tritone away, like, but also make it flow from one section to the other. Like, it was kind of fun to be like, how can we make this work, but also, like, be sneaky about it.
Mm-hmm. We were listening to it earlier, and we were trying to figure out if, like, the whole thing was written, or if there was some improvisation involved.
There is sections, most of it is through composed, but there are sections in a few tunes that are improvised, where we just kind of had chord changes that we would move on. That's very Mahavishnu Orchestra influence, yep. that we were...
you guys were both in that ensemble that year as well, right? Is it?
Yeah. Off their first album, we did that, and there's one tune on that album that has basically... Whenever they feel like it, they go to the next chord, so that's kind of how we approached it. And that's noticeable mostly on Dragon's Dream, which is the seventh tune.
Just one thing I noticed, which was really cool, like, genre aside, one of the most interesting things I found about the album is how, you know, knowing, I know you,
Kessler, I know you too.
I don't think that's a big shock to anyone, or, and I also know Lynn quite well, musically and personally, and your personality and your musical influences really shine through in your playing. So it's a wonderful melding of your sensibilities and Alin's sensibilities just coming together. And I think that's what makes the best dual recordings, is two sort of different players. Like, you guys aren't, you know...
Well, we're come from completely different backgrounds. And the fact that the music is what it is, like, when we get together, that it sounds like that, is like, I could never write that with anyone else. Like, mm-hmm. that's not my default, like... Oh, I write this kind of arty music.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I play more groove-oriented things and, you know, do wanky solos.
Yeah.
But over the playing with Lynch, just like, it inspires a part of me that, you know, only someone else can. And I like to say I inspire her too, but I can't speak for her.
You say that for the Juno speech.
Well, you've been nominated for some awards for this, haven't you?
Oh, yes, we have. So far, even before it was released, we were nominated for 3 awards. One of them was Best Jazz at the Toronto Independent Music Awards, which we did not win, we found out, but we were very happy with the nomination.
It's great.
Mm-hmm. Considering we're not really jazz, but hey, whatever.
Hey, you said chamber jazz, man. Perfect.
I did, okay. It's true. There. Can't take it back. No, that was really awesome. So that kickstarted, and then for the Independent Music Awards, which is an international thing with some pretty heavy judges for that, like McCoy Tyner, but we were nominated for 2 categories: for Best Instrumental Song and Best kind of Classical Album.
Very cool. Nice. Congratulations.
Thank
cool.
you.
And has that happened yet?
I have no idea. They have 2 stages. They have a stage where the judges decide, and then where they have a people's choice.
Okay.
And I haven't really checked it, because I've been quite busy.
That goes on the old to-do list.
Yes.
How does the process work for you in terms of, like, hearing about the nomination? Like, did you just... send you an email or something?
No, Lynn is applying for that kind of stuff. She's on top of it. Well, I'm handling more of the, production aspect of the album. she's like, we're splitting the, because there's a lot of stuff to do when putting out a CD and also getting it to, like, getting it out there. So she just submitted it to a few places, and it got picked up, which was really nice to know that, you know, like, we're really attached to the music because it's our own, but it's really hard to, you know, necessarily share that music knowing that some people might not like it. But the fact that response has been good is like, wow, that feels amazing.
Nice. So now you guys have this album in your hand. What's the plan?
Well, apart from selling copies to every boy, girl, and dragon. hilarious. Good one, Andrew. We plan to hopefully write some more music. I'm not sure if there'll be necessarily a Dragon Suite Part 2, but we're looking to actually get this repertoire under our fingers again, and we're hoping to play part of the Spectrum 2013-14 season for a concert in January, perhaps. So we've applied for that, and we think that's very hopeful we might get it, as well as maybe hopefully trying to get it on radio. We've already submitted to CBC. It's in their library. Maybe have it on the radio there, as well as find anyone we know who might be able to get it licensed, maybe in a film. Because I feel it could be part of a soundtrack or bits of it.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
I think that's kind of how we're thinking of the music, maybe to be used, if it's to be used in any sort of licensing at all. But just getting it out there is the toughest thing.
A lot of work involved, though, in doing that, eh?
Just yeah, like, to do it yourself is, yeah. I mean, thankfully, people are great about sharing it and telling people about it. But it's a monstrous amount of work.
Did you look into getting like some kind of like hiring someone to help you put it out there, like some kind of promoter or something like that? Or
are you offering?
I would have no idea what I'm doing, but, you know. This is the most of my capabilities right here, you know.
I'll do it if you pay me.
We've had some publicists on the show.
Yeah, with Emma, right?
Emma
was a publicist. Yeah, she came on the show.
Good to know. Yeah, I would be into it. Everything we've done so far has been just self-contained, which has been good, but also we need to reach more people. But as soon as we released the album, we both went we left Toronto to, like, you know, a good friend got married, so we were kind of away. So we kind of released the album, and then we were gone for a few weeks. So now I'm back, so now I kind of got to get the ball rolling.
Right. And Lynn's still in LA right now, right?
I think she just got there, so hopefully she'll be able to give it to some influential people there.
Yeah, no kidding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be very cool. I want to ask you about the really cool thing about this album for me. Like, obviously the music is very, very cool and interesting, but the artwork and like the whole like photography aspect is like ridiculous. Like the cover photo is insane. You guys did a music video that was just like gorgeous. Aww. You filmed in like some ridiculous like Garden of Eden location, I think.
Yeah, it was available for rent.
Yeah, so that's good. can you talk about that whole process and like also like working with the team that filmed?
Yeah, no, of course. And Alin and I had an idea, because this was a concept album, basically. It was a self-contained, it kind of just had a vibe about it that maybe we wanted to collaborate with other people. Initially, we wanted to collaborate with a photographer who did a lot of underground photography, meaning subterranean, like caverns. But who specializes in that kind of thing, like Dragon Cave, that kind of works.
Yeah.
But it ended up not working out with him. And then we were thinking of maybe having a short story written to kind of go along with it. And then that really didn't, flesh out either. But what happened is Alin has a good friend who's a famous photographer named Benjamin Von Wong, who's a good friend of mine now. And he was in town, and he listened to the music. He's like, yeah, we should just do a photo shoot. I've always been wanting to put a piano in the woods, and we'll just do something really ridiculous. And you should shoot a music video for one of your tunes. And we're like, oh, I guess we could do that. So we found the tune that was kind of fit best for a self-contained music video, which happened to be the quirky tune. So it ended up, we wrote we had very little time before this happened, so we did a simultaneous photo and video shoot, which I don't recommend doing, but it can be done. And I think it went really well. So my brother flew from Saskatoon. He's a photographer as well as a video editor and director and filmer, everything. And along with Ben, who does that stuff too. And because Ben's so popular, he was able to be like, hey, is anyone in the area that can help out shoot this thing? And because he's got some internet notoriety, he got like 5 people out. So we just had people who just helping us do it. Nevin Dunn, Humber grad, good friend of mine. He's a piano mover. He helped me move the piano. Our lead guy backed out. So I said, hey, Nevin, you're playing the lead in the video. He's like, all right. You did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
So we had a piano placed by the water and me and Lynn playing it for our photo as well as parts of that in the video. And then we wrote a kind of cute little love story between like a kind of cute elf girl and Nevin, who's just like a traveling kind of wanderer. And
they love pianos.
Yeah, and he's hopelessly dreamy, of course. Yeah, so.
Yes, a few days of not shaving and he's just got this, just the right amount of growth.
It's key.
Yeah, so that came together rather quickly, but after a lot of work, and my brother did a fantastic job on the editing of the video. He took all that nonsense that we filmed and made it into something sensical and beautiful. And Von Wong did the album cover. He just it's a real location. It's Rouge Valley or Rouge Hill, wherever that park is called, kind of east by Scarborough.
Cool.
And we just spent the whole day there, and then over the months we just kind of put everything together slowly, because it's you know, for your own projects it's hard to really get the ball rolling. It's like, oh, I have so much other work to do, and then by the time you're done it's like, oh, I don't really want to do my own stuff because I'm tired.
Yeah. And there's no like immediate
gratification.
Yeah, like, yeah, takes a while for that.
Yeah, I need someone. Sometimes I need someone pushing my butt to do their work. Or in the sense, like, I can't push my own butt too often.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm glad we did take the time, because it was done right and done well, given what we had and what we were out to do. So,
yeah. It's pretty cool. Again, we'll put up the link to the album, of course.
Yeah.
You can just download from Bandcamp, right? That seems to be...
Bandcamp is preferable, because you can get whatever format you want. And more of the profits go to us.
Which format would you suggest? Like, high quality, I guess? Or
I mean...
FLAC
is good. Wave is good. I mean, whatever. It's music. Like, when it comes down to it, we can talk, you know, bit depth and all that.
No, never again.
But yeah, so you can download that way. And if you do download Bandcamp, you also get a free copy of the music video as well.
Nice.
So in case you want to have that. Because, I mean, you can stream it on YouTube, of course. But in case you wanted to be like, I want to put this on my iPod or my laptop, so when I go visit Granny in the woods who doesn't have internet, I can watch this video over and over. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't blame you.
As well you should. Because visiting Granny is terrible.
Yeah, and we have a website. Our official name, because we want to use our names, is Homsey Kessler Duo. And that's all one word. You go to homseykesslerduo.com. You can see the music video. You can see the behind the scenes of how we made the music video. And there's also an album promo video that we made that includes studio session footage, because we filmed all the studio sessions. And it gives you even more information about how this album came to be.
Cool. I guess we should ask about the thing of the day.
Sure.
The issue of the day.
It is a good thing to ask about.
The issue of the day.
So we usually, whenever we have a guest on, whenever we have like something we're talking about in the banter section of the show, which is like never, because we apparently don't do that anymore. We like to ask the guest's opinion on what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So today, we talked a little bit about the ethics, sort of recording shows that you're going to, in terms of like from an audience perspective or from a musician's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about mostly me. I was like annoyed at the fact that I had to like look at all these like screens when I'm trying to watch this show, and like how people are like taken out of it or stuff like that, you know, taken out of the moment. This is like me. You guys didn't really agree with me, I don't think.
I mean, when people have like their iPods.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, you're not going to really get anything great quality from that. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a bit of a weird banter topic, because like we're like, if you were an artist and you were playing a show, how would you feel about people like recording it?
We're like recording audio and stuff like that. I mean, like, part of me, I like Phish's thing where they, that band, where they basically would release bootlegs of their own shows. And it was just a good way to get a fan base, you know? Mm-hmm. People who were at that show could be like, I was there, I enjoyed that. Like, those moments that they're playing, I was there.
Right.
I mean, I think that's okay. And at this point, like, if they really want to download your music for free, they can find a way.
Yeah.
But if they want to, like, remember kind of that night, it's just... I mean, I'm not sure how much money people can make off of bootlegging shows. If I'm talking about my own shows, I mean, I rarely think... I mean, as much as I love the groups I play in, you know, it's hard to think that someone's, you know, someone in Taiwan is making $1 million selling it, you know, on 8-track somewhere to, like, a village.
The entire village. That's a very interesting view of, like, global economics that you have there.
That's, like, a very specific circumstance. That's
something that happened in Taiwan, like, or you? There's a village of a fisherman, like, gets the new fish tape and puts it in his 8-track excitedly. And
yeah. Really boosted it, and, oh, man, it sounds like this.
Oh, man. So we also want to ask our guests, like, what they're working on at the moment, chance to promote themselves. Obviously, you have the album.
Yes.
We'll put up the link to that. We'll
give all Thank you. Much obliged.
Yeah. do you have any other, like, shows going on right now? I know you're very busy in terms of music things.
Yeah, I guess, well, my own stuff. Well, my band, Soma, which I play with, it's a four-piece. It's, I call it progressive funk. It's got, it's very rock ish but also funky and groovy, but it's got some jazz, got some fusion, but not like the Chick Corea kind, which is the 80s stuff which everyone hates but loves at the same time.
I got my record of him of the Seventh Galaxy at home.
Oh yeah, no,
I was listening to that today. It's sick.
Sorry, let me rephrase that. I'm probably gonna piss a lot of people off.
We'll edit it out.
Our good friend Mr. Korea. Yeah.
Friend of the show, Chick Corea.
I do have, if we're on the a little quick Chick Corea tangent, his album that's inspired by Scientology, like The Greatest Adventure or whatever, is worth a listen. I do recommend it if you're into kitsch.
The Ultimate Adventure?
The Ultimate Adventure.
I didn't know that was fucking.
Oh no, it's a Scientology concept album, my friend.
I don't like it at all.
Oh, there you go. Wonderful.
Oh, okay. I have to listen to it again. Last time I heard it was like years ago.
No. You should listen to it again. It's one of the most like unintentionally hilarious things I've ever heard. Good. Anyway,
So Soma's doing some stuff.
Soma. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'll start that again. So my band Soma, which is a instrumental funk group, progressive funk, I like to call it. We are just finishing mixing the last track of our album, another full album, and that'll hopefully be released in the next couple months. I want to give some time after this one, but as far as my creative projects, that's one of them. I play around the city with as a kind of a hired gun for a lot of people, as well as I do mixing. So if you need your album mixed, you know. That's something I do. Nick, I've worked on an album with him.
He's a fantastic mixing engineer. I heartily recommend this guy.
I hardly recommend that fucker.
I hardly recommend this young whippersnapper.
And then a cappella has always been super important to me. My quartet Rendezvous is unfortunately on probably a hiatus for a long time as our lead got married and is living out west now. So his life is over. We love him. But arranging for a cappella, maybe trying to put together some groups is something I always do on the side. But
cool. Nice. Cool. Very cool, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on. It was cool to talk about the album.
Yeah, it was awesome, man.
Thanks for letting me ramble.
Hey, man. That's all we do. That's all we fucking do. Cool, man. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay, welcome back to episode 12 of Hits and Gigs. We are now very happy to be joined by Tom Richards of the band River Run. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. Thanks for coming on. We brought you on because you have this very cool project going on. It's going to be in just over 2 weeks now. Do you want to tell us a bit about
the project, like what it is?
Yeah, sure. This is with my band, River Run. As you said, it's Peter Lutek, Scott Peterson, and Jake Ulrichs, and myself. And on August 24th, we're doing a 12-hour marathon show. So we're going to start at 2 p.m. and go until 2 a.m. without any breaks. So that's the short version of it. And the longer, slightly longer version is that the admission is charged by the minute. So basically, the Indiegogo page is where we're doing admission. It's 25 cents a minute. And that gets you into the show, and it also gets you a recording of the music that's played during the time that you're there. So basically, everyone gets their own CD of the experience, because you sign in and you sign out. And you show up multiple times if you want to, and I'll send you the chunks that were recorded during all the different times that you you show up on the 24th. So that's basically the idea.
It's very cool. So it's I guess like it's going to be a fair amount of work for you afterwards, eh? Like sorting through everything and getting all the audio to everyone.
Yeah, it'll be a pretty good amount of work, I think. But I think if I'm smart about it, I can set things up so it's less work. You know, we're not going to be recording like 36 channels of audio or anything like that. It's going to be fairly simple, and I'm pretty organized with you know, the way I do things. So hopefully it'll be all right. It's definitely lots of work leading up to it. I'm doing lots of writing, and we've got a ton of special guests that'll be joining us through the day. So we're just kind of coordinating how that's going to work and writing for these different people who are coming in to play with us. And, you know, of course, the promotional side of things takes some time as well. But yeah, it'll be worth it, though. It's a fun adventure, I guess.
Nice.
Tom, actually, on the topic of the music, I was going through and I was seeing like some of the perks for buying in for a certain amount of time. Like, you were going to write or compose pieces for people,
yeah,
for specific people.
Yeah, those are for the big spenders. Yeah, if you sign up for the requisite amount of time, I'll write a 5 or a 10 minute piece for you. So I've done a few of those already. And I've got one more in the queue that I need to get writing. But yeah, basically, I'll write a tune for you. And if you have any particular requests about what you want the tune to kind of represent, then that's all good and everything like that. But yeah, and so now I'm just kind of doing that work and putting it all in line in the schedule, looking at the day and deciding, you know, when things are going to happen. And since there's a kind of a continuum of music, there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen like at a specific time in the day. So like, you know, the set list is kind of on the clock rather than, you know, just being in order of things.
So, very cool.
That's a different set of challenges than I'm used to, but I'm totally stoked about it. It's you know, this is a fun band, and they're just up for anything, these guys, which is, you know, pretty lucky about.
Yeah. Could you actually just tell us a bit about the music itself, Tom?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, this band is just, it's like my dream band, in the sense that the musicians are fantastic to work with, and I've worked with these guys for a lot of years, but it's also just kind of, I get to do exactly what I want to do, and I get to kind of like fulfill all of my musical fantasies. So we do a lot of stuff. I guess it reflects, you know, I have a varied taste in music, so it's not really any particular genre, but like electro chamber jazz is one thing that I've kind of toyed with, and you know, ambient minimalist avant-garde pop is another thing. But you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. Nice. And it's, I guess the music is really, it's really shaped by the individuals. So I write the tunes, but there's a lot of freedom for the guys to do what they want, because I have complete trust in them. So nice. Peter Lutek, he brings this Turkish clarinet, in the key of G, and he's got a whole set of you know, electronic hardware and software that he's designed himself. And so he's got this whole space station to play with, and Scott Peterson is like doing like tube and throat singing and playing igil and kalimba and, you know, playing with, you know, playing effects pedals with his feet while playing bass. And Jake Ulrichs is just a completely unique guy that you can throw him into any situation and he'll make it sound good. So, yeah, basically it's, you know, it's all of that stuff.
Wow. So is it going to be mostly written, or is there going to be like a lot of like, I guess, maybe like verging on like free improv stylistically, or...
One thing I don't want it to turn into is a big kind of like mess of directionless improvisation. And I don't ever think there's a danger of that with this group of people, but I think that's my big challenge as a writer at the moment, I think, is looking at the big picture. So I've got some structured improv stuff that we've done. I've got a 45-minute piece that we performed at Array a few months ago, that was 45 minutes of basically, you know, there's guidelines for improvising. We've got some material like that, and then I've got lots of written material that I'm gonna kind of like place. Those will be like the bricks, and there will be improvising will be the mortar between the bricks, basically.
Pretty cool. How did you, like, it was your idea, I assume, to do this, was it? Or was it like a joint decision?
It was my idea, although Peter Lutek has been kind of talking somewhat facetiously over the years about doing, you know, something on this scale. And so we've talked about it kind of in a pipe dream kind of way for a while. And he always, at the end of, you know, our regular 2 or 3 hour gigs, he always, you know, says that he's just getting warmed up. So it was finally time to call his bluff.
Jesus. So I'm wondering, like, how did you bring this idea forward to the other musicians in the band? Like, how did you pitch it to them?
I was like, guys, we're gonna just do a thing, and they were all into it, man. I mean, that's the thing, is that you know, Jake is just like has limitless supplies of energy in life, it seems, and so he was just instantly into it. And Peter is just an extreme dude, and he was like, yeah. And Scott's just his approach to it is just like, well, I better start training. And so he's like, you know, he's Scott is just in the training mode, I think, for getting ready to play upright bass for 12 hours. Although, you know, it's a big part of what we're going to be doing is not playing our instruments in a traditional way. And I'm going to bring a sampler and do lots of stuff like that. There will definitely be some delay pedals involved, and part of having the special guests join us as well is just being able to inject different energy into the day, you know, from time to time, so that it's not all on us just to be playing tunes, you know, straight up and down. So yeah, but the guys were totally into it. They're just amazing people, amazing musicians. So
nice.
Tom, I was wondering if you could actually, do you have anything you can say about the special guests?
Yeah. Well, I guess I should just enumerate these amazing people that are going to be with us. So we've got two out-of-town contributors, Avi Granite, who's a guitarist living in New York right now, from Toronto, and Kip Jones, who's a violinist, who's also living in New York and Minneapolis. Both of those guys are going to be kind of writing, composing, and improvising half an hour of material each that we're going to incorporate into our set. So they're sending me those like wave files, basically, and we're going to be playing along with that, and I'm going to write music to underscore what they've done. So that's two things that are happening. We're going to have Steve Ward come in for a set on trombone. He's just an incredible improviser. We're having Allison Tofan come in, and she's a tap dancer who can hang with the heaviest jazz guys that have, you know, she's just an incredible musician. So she'll be in for a set as well. And then we're going to have a mystery trio joining us. That's our last event within the event. So That's happening at 10:30, the Mystery Trio.
You said that the last special guest was going to be a... You say tap dancer? Is that what you said? Or?
Yeah.
So she's going to be tap dancing along while you play, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you guys go about like writing a piece of music for that? Like, I guess she would do that
or something. Well, she's an improviser, and so that's how I know her, really, is I've played with her a few times and heard her play with like small groups. And so I was kind of wondering that same thing, actually. I asked her to do this, and she was really into it, and then I had a meeting with her, and I was kind of like trying to approach the subject of how do I write for a dancer, and you know, much to my relief, she said, "Oh, just write me a chart." So she's gonna read stuff that I write, basically, and I'll have to deal with having something not on a music stand, and you know, so there'll be some stuff from our regular book that I think we're going to play, and there will be we're going to hopefully mess with some contact mics and triggers so that we can kind of explode her tap dancing sound a little bit. But yeah, she's an incredible musician, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Now, Tom, I noticed you guys are doing admission for the show through Indiegogo. Can you explain why you guys decided to do that and not, say, a more traditional method of admission?
I just wanted to do it in a way that would really frame the concept of paying by the minute, which I think is... It's kind of an interesting way to do it, and basically to have it online means that people can access this, and I can communicate with them beforehand and afterwards. I have their email address, and everything is just really well organized that way. So basically, it's, you know, you go to the site and you sign up for a certain amount of time. And then on the day of, you show up. And I should add too, it's also for people that don't live in Toronto, right? So I expect that I've already had a number of people contribute to, you know, the campaign or basically buy admission for the show who aren't going to be here for the show, but they still get a recording.
Right.
So, you know, even if you live in Timbuktu, you can buy 20 minutes of music, and you can either tell me which 20 minutes you want to hear, or you can, or I'll like pick it for you, basically. So, yeah. So those two reasons, basically, just the organizational factor, and also allowing people from out of town to participate.
Nice.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's a super cool idea.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's a Saturday, so I think it'll be it's a good day for people who are just kind of, you know, out and about in the city, and you know, you can stop in a couple times. This is the kind of thing where you can you know, stop by at 2:30 in the afternoon and then go grab a coffee somewhere and then maybe see a show later at the night and then come back at 1 a.m. and we'll still be going, and you know, I probably it'll be a different energy at that point, but yeah, we're really looking forward to having people stopping in and, you know, coming and going all day, and I'm scheduling, you know, little breaks for the musicians as well, so we can, you know, in shifts, kind of like go and, you know, dunk our heads in ice water or whatever needs to happen.
drink like a liter of coffee, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to have the, one of those beer hats.
Full of coffee.
Just two venti Starbucks, you know, bowls on my head.
All right. Actually, Tom, I was also curious a bit about the venue, because I was looking on the Indiegogo page and I haven't been to this particular venue.
Right. Yeah, that's important to mention where it's happening. Beit Zetun, Beit Zetun House, I guess, is the full name. It's 612 Markham Street, which is right across from Honest Ed's, or for those musicians out there who know the Central, it's right across from the Central.
Okay.
And you've probably walked by it a million times and never really noticed it, but it's a beautiful space. I was there with Ali Burcock's Battleship Potemkin project last fall, and it sounds brilliant, and it's It's a really large open space with good lights, and yeah, it's going to be nice and comfortable. They've got couches to chill out on. They, you know, they always have coffee on. So it's yeah, it's got the kind of, it hits all the right spots for me. It's a great location for people just to pop in. It's Bathurst Subway, so it's easy to access, and then, you know, it's got lots of space. It sounds good and all that stuff. So
nice.
Yeah, really nice spot.
I can definitely see that. I've walked past there many, many times, and I never knew it was there.
Yeah.
Were they very open to the 12-hour marathon as well, or did it take a bit of convincing to get them to sign on with it?
No, they're into it. And they're very supportive. Robert has you know, really been helpful with you know, suggestions for promotion and stuff like that. It's going to be a great place to do it. They're really, they seem to be really concerned about making sure that things are successful, the events that they put on are successful, which obviously makes sense, but it's good for us too. And I think it's a rare thing these days where, the proprietor of a space where musicians are coming into is actually taking an active role in helping to make the thing go and to make the thing successful. So that's kind of, yeah, it's nice.
That's good to hear. Because I feel like a lot of the time it's like when you're booking a show, it's like two separate sides almost, but, you know, not necessarily, but just like at times it feels like, I don't know. It's just good to hear that you're working together.
In a lot of cases, it seems like musicians are kind of, like, the venue just leaves musicians on their own to get people out, and it's really nice to see a venue taking part in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's the kind of thing, I mean, I hope to be able to reach out to people beyond just the musician scene. I mean, being a big music nerd, most of my friends are big music nerds, too. I think that part of the appeal of River Run is that it's accessible. We're not playing super esoteric stuff. It's not all weird 100% of the time, you know? So I think that's coming from the types of things I like to listen to. I think that it appeals to people, but it's hard to get folks out, you know? So that's part of the reason why I want to do special things with this band. Like, I try to make it a different event, a different kind of occasion every time we go out. We've released, you know, a cassette tape this year. We released a USB stick this year.
Nice.
And we're always trying to make it a special occasion, because I think that appeals to people more than just, hey, my band's playing a show.
Yeah,
definitely.
I have a question about in terms of like the promotion. Mm-hmm. And like getting word out there about the show, and like who specifically you're targeting to come to the show. You already mentioned that you know, if people are just in the downtown area, it'd be great to stop by, like whenever you just want to like chill and watch some music as like a break from your downtown activities or whatever. But like, is there like a certain way that you're going about this that's like targeting certain people to come out to the show?
No, do you have any ideas?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm doing everything myself, basically. So I don't have a tremendous amount of experience doing this, but I guess I've got more experience than I did, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. So I'm happy kind of just going along and learning as I go, and doing all the stuff that I know how to do, which is, you know, it's not really. It's not really gonna take me to the top of the charts or anything like that, but that's always gonna be, I think, the challenge with music that is not mainstream, you know, especially now when it's really hard to get people out of their houses to come down and participate in something that's happening live. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's always gonna be a challenge to get people in the door, but once they're in the door, I think we tend to hold on to our audience. We tend to connect with people. So word of mouth is obviously a big thing, but also just the really mundane stuff of, like, you know, writing to newspapers and
yep.
You know, just connecting with people. So,
nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
I got one more question. In terms of, you mentioned that the set list is more of like a list based on time of day.
Yeah.
Are you, in terms of like the guests showing up, is it going to be like made public when they're playing, or is it just going to be like, come on down, you might catch them or something like that?
Absolutely. Well, maybe here, let me just pull it up. I think I've got my schedule here somewhere.
Oh, cool.
On my computer. Yeah. Okay. So we've got Avi Granit, who's going to be contributing a set at 4:30 to 5. Steve Ward is going to be in from 6 o'clock to 6:45. Kip Jones is going to be in from 7:30 to 8. Of course, he's coming in not physically, but just his music. Nice. Allison Tofan, the dancer, will be 9 o'clock to 9:45. And then our as yet mystery trio is going to be 10:30 to 11:15 p.m.
Cool.
So we've got, you know, basically we've got, you know, I'm not going to be doing a lot of counting in of tunes. It's going to be kind of like, look at the clock. It's 3:05 and it's time to play this tune, and we're just going to hit it from wherever we are, you know, in the continuum of sound that's happening.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So if people want to contribute to the campaign, they can go to indiegogo.com/projects/riverrun-marathon. Or I guess you can just type in River Run Marathon Indiegogo. I'm sure it'll show up that way too.
It does.
Nice.
Yeah. And we've got a Facebook event as well. So, you know, the more people that join up, it has a way of kind of snowballing and hopefully we gain momentum and reach our goal, because I don't really want to pay all this money out of my own pocket.
Yeah. Can't blame you, man. Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to it. I think everyone seemed really excited about it, everyone that I talked to. So I'm just going ahead and doing tons of work to get ready for the musical side of it, and yeah, it's going to be a great time.
Nice. Yeah, it's so interesting to me because it's something that's so unique, and like I feel like it can be something pretty special. So
yeah, it'll be a fun day.
Nice. Cool. Well, Tom, thanks a lot for coming on, man. Looking forward to the event.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Cool, man.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Welcome back to Hits and Gigs, episode 12. Thank you to Tom Richards for coming on. Thank you to Andrew Kessler for coming on.
Yeah.
Applause. Yes, yeah, applause, yeah, applause, yeah. Applause. I don't know, we had great discussions, and I guess we'll look to catch up with you guys again in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds great. Good.
Hey, sorry, Nick. Thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, anytime.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
All right, so take care, guys. See you in 2 weeks.
Peace.